I have enormous privilege to be in London with my wonderful friend and terrific artist, Anthony Gormley. It's Sunday. We are in north part of London, very close to King's Cross. It's beautifully sunny. And we are in this magnificent studio, and I have wonderful opportunity to ask Anthony questions about the progress of his work. We worked together, Anthony, back in the early 80s.
84.
Perfect. You have an excellent memory. And I was just recently looking at some photographs and also at some books, and I realized that some of the projects or some of the ideas you had then, you really have continued in a magnificent way.
Yeah, I'm very boring.
I don't think it's boring. I have this wonderful postcard of Land, Sea and Air, number 2 from 1982. Mm. And as I was looking at it and at the same time contemplating your new piece, Horizon Field, which you are developing in Austria, you will be doing it from 2:10 to 2:12.
Yeah, no, it's there. It's there. It's been there. It's been there from 2:10. We opened it in July of last year.
I see. Mm. The figure and the relationship of the figure to space or to nature really was there absolutely from the first moment.
Yeah, it's true.
Tell me about it. Tell me how you really
started. Well, I think it's interesting when you think about our show and what was in it.
Oh, I remember.
Nearly every single work in it has
Cloud.
has its companion or cousin or grandchild in the studio now, and it's rather wonderful. I mean, it's a very special moment for me, in a way, to be sitting here with you, and I don't suppose there are many people who have followed the work over that distance. I should explain that Dorian Hobday, who is my dear friend and assistant, he's working on a Sunday because he's a musician. He's been working with me for 12 years, but if you hear the odd in the background, that's Dorian welding a work called Aperture. But just to go back to where I was, the first work that you saw in the Riverside show, which is the show that Milena and I did in 1984 in a wonderful gallery close to the river in Hammersmith, there was a cloud as the first work, this lead object that hovered just above your head, which was about 15 foot long, about 6 foot high, and about 9 feet wide. And there are now, maybe in the main studio we just saw, there are certainly three or four clouds. Then in that show there was also a work called Tree, which was a standing body form with an extension that made the head about 12 foot long, and the resulting work was about a 16 foot high tall man with a neck like a giraffe. And the last show that I made in White Cube, and certainly the works that I'm about to show at Tadeusz Ropak in Paris, also have extensions. In both cases, the cloud and the extended work, the idiom has somewhat changed. So the clouds in the studio now are all made out of a bubble matrix, and the extensions are all made from extended rectangles. But I could go on, because there was another work in that show called Home.
Exactly.
Which was a lying lead piece with its head in a terracotta house the size of a doll's house. And this idea of the reconciliation of our physical experience of space with a notion of in a way, consciousness itself having a spatial principle. The Tibetans have this wonderful phrase, which is the sky nature of mind. And I think now, with so much neuroscience telling us about the, in a way, the mapping of the brain, I think we are liable to forget its principle and extraordinary nature, which Descartes understood, which is that, you know, mind has no boundaries. It can, it has this potential to extend into space. And I think right from the beginning I was trying to reconcile this fundamental paradox of the human condition, that we live, as it were, materialized within the borrowed coordinates of a highly complex carbon life matrix, and yet this material basis for life also is, in a way, the context in which consciousness rises, and consciousness itself is unexplainable, except that it is infinitely extendable. And I guess I'm still trying to deal with that fundamental problem, and or you could say, huge blessing of the human capability, that what we can imagine is so different from maybe what we experience. And for me, this is the basis of art, and always has been, that art is a catalyst for, in a way, imagining and giving ourselves tools for the realization of other ways of being, of thinking, of doing.
As I prepared and thought about you, I also have asked my colleague Glenn Dixon to come up with some questions.
Oh, that's nice.
With something really interesting. He said that even though your work grapples with profound philosophical and maybe religious issues, does the fact that the basis of it is the figure, all these ideas are kind of within the presence of this figure that you work with, make it more accessible to a broader public?
Yeah, I mean, that was very much my... I consciously took the risk at a time when it was much higher risk than now, to return to the body. I would say, I don't use the word figure, because figure mm-hmm. suggests, in a sense, a tradition which could be called academic, of the understanding of anatomy, the way that mm-hmm. bone and muscle and skin work together to make a believable body that you can then put to work in the 19th century, usually by large, often historical or mythological subjects. I'm thinking now of people like Alma Tadema or Moore, or I'm talking about Albert Moore, the sort of neoclassicist pre-Aphrodite. And I reject that. I don't like the idea of the figure as this known trope within art. I want to start again with something that I refer to as the body. And I'm absolutely not interested in the relationship of bone to muscle to skin, or in putting the figure to work in a narrative sense. I'm really just wanting to say, what is a body? How can we maybe apply to it what we know now about the... I mean, it's just fantastic. The explosion of the post-Newtonian idea of what is matter. How can we apply the understanding that actually E equals mc squared. I mean, the notion of relativity, the notion that actually mass and energy are twin sides of the same condition. How do we recognize that actually fixed bodies that are have been the very subject, central subject of sculpture, can no longer simply be taken for granted? We have to recognize that in the manner of quantum mechanics, everything is arising, everything is becoming. There is no such thing as fixity. And I believe that part of my project is to try to apply to the body as the closest bit of the material world that any one of us engages in. How do we apply to that, in a way, material reality, the knowledge that we have gained since the general theory of relativity in 1915? And anyway, sorry, that was a very long way of answering your colleague's question. The fact is, I return to the body in order to deal with direct experience, in order to start with something that was common. This was the common human condition. And I do want, you know, I'm very suspicious of art that comes out of art. And right from the beginning, I have wanted, in a way, to make work that was readily accessible or, could be engaged with by anybody, either in terms of direct experience, because I think while I have, as it were, embodied the body in a lot of work, there are also parallel with that, and that has always been there right from the beginning, parallel with that, there has been the desire to make physical spaces that become an instrument through which the viewer becomes aware of their own time and movement and scale in space.
Would you think it's significant that you started with the body, your own body, really in the 80s, where there was a return to the body in the visual art, and the different artists have taken it on a different way?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was one of the first. I mean, I'm just trying to think of who else there was when I started. And I suppose there's Kiki, and there's Kiki looking at the body in
Kiki
pieces.
Smith.
Yeah, Kiki Smith looking at the body in pieces, a very pathological study of the body. I think, from a sort of analytical, medical, and feminist point of view, the deconstructed body. We have a very traditional view, in my view, of the body in art by Balkanal, who is looking at... he started at roughly the same time as me. I find his work fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't go very far, so far as I'm concerned. It's a very understandable return to the tradition of Middle European Limewood carving, taken out of a religious context and made secular and vernacular, men in black trousers with white shirts and women often quite sort of traditionally pretty, and then sort of a salute to the notion of expressionism with a fairly loose surface, but I'm being very mean. I mean, I think that all of the strategies that Balkanal uses of acknowledging the trunk they are all basically, this is imagistic work, and I'm very suspicious of image-based work. And who else is there? Then there's Katharina Fritsch. And who else? And then Juan Munoz, but he started much later than me, I believe.
And you really were working with your own body.
Yeah, I think my work has always tried to be you know, I'm not interested in... I think of the whole project as being... It is in the manner of A.J. Eyre, Truth, Language and Logic, or a precursor of him, you know, John Locke. I am an empiricist. I want to work with direct experience, and I want it to start with real things. So I start with a real body in real time and a real event that I try to capture. And I can't ask other people to undergo... I want it to start with the other. You know, the Kantian inquiry into the relationship between a priori and empirical experience is... an acknowledgement of the necessary subjectivity of truth. And I think, you know, so far as I'm concerned, that's the other part of my project. I want to reconcile the necessary particularity and individuality of each and every one of our experience of the world by starting with my own. Not because I think mine's special, but because I have to acknowledge that particularity, mm-hmm. and I can't think of any. You know, it's very practical. I believe that I'm supremely practical. I am just saying, my body is the closest bit of the material world that I am ever going to experience. Furthermore, it has the advantage of me being able to work on it from the inside. Now, interestingly enough, right in that very statement is the paradox that I am making an object, I am making a material proposition, a thing in the world, that nevertheless deals with subjective experience. And I would say that's the strength of my position, if you like. And it's independent, I think, of all of these questions of taste or of style or indeed of the way that art is... marketed, and I don't mean that simply from the point of view of economic marketing. I mean marketed in terms of the economics of understanding. The primary pump of the evolution of art has been the notion that one in Gombrich's terms, strategy for the rendering of a understandable and believable image of the world follows another. And the 20th century is a wonderful, mm-hmm. A wonderful sort of bridge between, you know, you could start with 1905 with an early kind of cubist work by Braque or Picasso and end up with Carl André's floor plates, and you mm-hmm. have a kind of continuum of ways of modelling the world. Well, I reject this as a easy and too easy idea about the it's a very Western, maybe even very American way of looking at progress as a kind of continuum of technological procedures. I'm not against techno. I'm not against understanding and immersing yourself in the languages of post-particle physics. However, I am not interested in style. I just think that the time of isms is over. There are much, mm-hmm. much more vital things to be getting to grips with.
Well, one of the things you said, art is useless unless it helps us to deal with survival.
Mm.
Is that the essence?
I don't know. I mean, that's... the question that begs the question: what do we mean by survival? And we can say there is. I would say that I would never deny the therapeutic aspects of art. So the first bit of survival that it deals with is the artist's own survival. The work that I make is a, I would like to think, a genuine attempt for me to understand my own physical and mental state, or anyway come close to an appraisal of it. And as such, it's a balancing mechanism. Mm-hmm. It saves me from going mad, if you like. Because I think a lot, and maybe too much, and making things is a wonderful foil to the other part of... If the mind has the sky nature of potential for infinite extension, it also has the opposite. It has the ability to drill into ever and ever finer qualifications and distinctions. You know, deductive reasoning is a very, very painful process because it can go on following a kind of Zeno's paradox of being able to divide everything that is left further. And I think making things is a way of balancing that kind of the acidity of the analytic mind. So personal survival is, or the therapeutic principle for art is one, I think, important part of its survival. But I would like to think there's a bigger thing, and this is at the absolute opposite spectrum, that the biggest single challenge that faces our species is the fact that we are now, we have based our life support systems on unsustainable sources of energy. And I think this is a cultural question, and certainly I don't know whether I mentioned it in the lecture I gave at the Phillips, but Jared Diamond's, you know, question is, you know, resonates for me, which is, you know, what was in the mind of the man who cut down the last tree on Easter Island, on Rapa Nui? He was doing what his father and his father's father had done, she thought was the right thing to do. But, in a sense, the last tree is just a metaphor. It's, why is it that we are constantly determined by, in a way, the things that are, that were done before us? Well, it's obvious that, you know, we drive our cars on roads that were often laid down thousands of years earlier because it was the affordance, the easiest way of getting from one place to another. And that notion of affordance, we can't afford anymore. And I would like to think that art, by providing us with useless objects which are only there as a, in a way, displacement of the necessary, allow us a space in which to think about alternative ways of being. And I suppose that my utopian view is that art, in both its being a diagnostic instrument in which we understand our own pathology, I mean that the pathology of mind as well as pathology of body, and an instrument in which we can auto-observe our own behaviour, becomes a necessary tool in maybe thinking about potential alternative futures. And I think that that's really, really important. So works like Event Horizon in New York, which I was very proud of.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for doing it.
Well, I was very proud of, because in a way, it's not easy to persuade. But it was the same in London, you know, to persuade government institutions, private individuals, corporations, city corporations, the highways and whatever department, the parks and all of those, you know, who rightfully ask, is this, strictly speaking, what we should be doing with our buildings, our roads and our parks? And it's a great tribute, I think, to Madison Square Park and Debbie Landau, that she had built enough good relations with those people in the centre of Manhattan to achieve their cooperation very, very quickly. It took us 2 years in London. We applied to 110 different buildings to get our 27. And
how did the idea come to you to do the figures within the city, on the parks and on the buildings? And of course, it would be nice to hear from you what you think was the difference in terms of an impact between London and New York. And you just told me that you felt that the New York was, in your view, more successful.
Yes, there are a lot of people who don't agree with that. They felt that the use of the river and the fact that it was much more intimate in London was better. But I'm just trying to remember how I got the idea. It all starts really from Lanciennes, as you said, Lanciennes 1982, which is these humanly made things put back into the elemental world, these three cases that are places where a human body once was, put onto a beach where a perception is related to an element, is related to a body position. So a standing figure with its, this is an empty lead box of a standing man, divided into equal horizontal strata of 7 1/4 inches. The eye holes open, connecting the void, dark interior of this box with a horizon, and placed by the sea. Air, a kneeling figure with its nostrils open, its head slightly tilted to the sky, at rest with its hands on its knees in a kind of Zen meditating position. And then land, a crouching figure, very, very low, with its back like the back of a tortoise, cocking its ear to the earth and the ear holes being open. Anyway, what those pieces were doing was saying, here are three potential human positions or body states that relate to an element and to a perception. And I guess I then, many years later, 13 years later, in 1995, made a work called Another Place, which was now solid works that I hope don't do the same thing. They evoke the space that a body contains, because I'm interested in the body as a place rather than a thing, as a space rather than as an object. But I still think of them, I still think of these solid forms, these 100 body forms that were made from 14 different molds. 17 different molds of different, with the breath at different levels of either inhalation or exhalation. And they all face directly out to the sea. They were made originally for Cuxhaven, which was an extraordinary place on the mouth of the Elbe, on the southern side of the Elbe estuary. Cuxhaven was a place where, along with Bremerhaven, between the fall of the Weimar Republic and the rise of Nazism, thousands of people left Germany, for the New World. And I was originally offered the old emigration halls to show Field, which was this work with thousands of small terracotta, which dealt with human futures and indeed with in a way, overpopulation and notions of ethnicity and all of that. But I thought this was the immigration halls themselves were so powerful that this wasn't right. And I was looking for other places, and I went and found this Vatnmýr, which is where the sea comes in over a very extended sand bank, 7 kilometers out to the horizon. And I realized that I could make this installation, which would invite people to walk out as they do anyway, allowing the muddy sand to squeeze between their toes. And I could make this completely horizontal field. And what was the idea of another place? The idea of another place was to link this the ideas of land, sea and air to with the idea of utopia. What was it that led the Israelites to leave Egypt? What was it that led the early Puritans to leave England for the New World? Was the idea that this is again linked to the notion of what are the spaces of art? It was the idea that they could imagine a better life where social justice and the freedom of belief was possible, but the other side of a visible horizon, beyond the known. And so I made this completely horizontal. It was really an amazing kind of job. We didn't have laser levelers or GPS in those days, and I can just remember spending a week with Jonathan Lakin Hall, my chief assistant then, with a theodolite, setting up these posts in the mud at exactly the same level. So the pieces became we started about a kilometer and a half out to sea, and the pieces were incrementally buried, determined by that eye level. So by the time we got back to the shore, they were buried, you know, up to their waists or even more. And anyway, that idea of exposing these body spaces to do with breath, always looking out to a horizon, was born there. And having done it in this very, very extreme environment of the seaside, it's a natural thing to then want to do something similar within the urban matrix. And that, you know, I think this all took kind of form in thinking about the fact that in 2005, we were told for the first time over 50% of the human race now lived within the urban grid. And it seems from demographic studies that by 2070, around 70% of the human race will live within the urban grid, where this relationship with a potential horizon, in other words, our relationship with the elemental world was going to be consistently eroded. So the idea of making a work where we had four pieces on the ground that you could bump into, and then another 27 that were isolated against the sky, looking out to a horizon that we, as embedded within the matrix of the city, couldn't see, was a way, I think, of dealing with the same issue. And you could say this is where the whole question of survival, I think, you know, this isn't a gloomy business, but we have to accept that at some point the human species will no longer be here. We will face extinction just like more species than exist now have faced extinction. And we have to recognize that we have a certain choice at the moment, which will not be available to us in even 25 years of modifying our behavior. We know that this 6 billion years worth of atomic fusion left in the sun. The sun is the source of all life, and we can decide whether we're going to prolong our, as it were, collaboration in the evolution of life forms on this planet or not. And I mean, I'm not offering any solutions, and I'm certainly, you know, this is not me banging the drum as a environmental protester, even though I think that, you know, I'm trying as well as I can to be as carbon neutral as possible. And I think that's the least we can do as individuals. But I think the real choice is whether or not we do use the sun and use the forces of gravity in terms of wave and water power. So solar, wind and water to power our lifestyles over and above ever depleted fossil fuels, which are, after all, really just the, in a way, stored solar energy that are within oil and coal.
Well, Anthony, thank you so much for your time.